Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We're joined in this portion of our program. I'm Bob Salter, and I've been looking forward to our discussion for some time because the title of the book that we're going to be talking about is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Now, you say that title, and in most cases, you get an immediate reaction. We're going to speak with the author of the book, Bernice Hausman. Bernice is chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine. I'm pleased to say that she is joining us on our program. First of all, good morning. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
In beginning this discussion, was that the only title for this book?
The first part, anti-vax, was. The second part, boy, that had a number of different iterations. The first one that I was working with for a long time was making sense of vaccine skepticism. And then there was a time when the title was a little bit clunkier, the subtitle. It was vaccine skepticism tells us about medicine or teaches us about medicine and modernity. And that comes up, that I think now is the title of the conclusion to the book. So the reframing the vaccination controversy was a conversation with the editor after she felt that the subtitles were just not doing the book justice. And the just as a funny side note, there was a long discussion about whether or not the should be in the whether it should be the vaccination controversy or whether it should be reframing vaccination controversy or reframing vaccination controversies. And I actually did a little crowdsourcing with friends of mine over email, my colleagues of mine, about whether we should have the in there or not. It was quite an amusing experience in retrospect. The issue was really whether or not we were implying there was only one. In the end, actually, it was a colleague of mine who used to be a journalist who said you need the in there because that's going to make it more less academic sounding and more inviting to the general reader, which I thought was really an interesting insight, and we went with that.
In your background, as I understand, you were vaccinated as a child, later as an adult, and in all honesty, I was vaccinated as a child as well. You had your own children vaccinated. Why this book? Why this approach?
So I study medical controversies in the public sphere, and I was finishing up a project and looking around for a new one, and I was also And at the time, I knew that colleagues of mine and friends of mine who had children after 2000, my kids were born in the mid 90s, that they were, even if they were vaccinating, they were worried about vaccinating, and some of them were delaying and kind of changing the recommended schedule for their children's vaccines. And I was really interested in that. I was sort of interested in why they had those concerns. And at the same time, I was also interested in developing a collaborative research group with students at Virginia Tech, where I was teaching at the time. And I was really interested in a topic that would capture the imagination of my students, who were mostly pre-med, the group of students that I was seeking to engage in this research and teach them about how to do humanities research as a team. And so I thought that this would be a good topic that would draw their interest, and I was right. Since that time, I've had different groups of 4 to 5 students every semester since 2010 doing research on this topic. And now I have moved that research group to Penn State College of Medicine, and I have medical students working with me on a project right now.
The vaccination decisions with your own children, you describe them as non-decisions. Why?
Because it was, I don't know, it was just what happened when they went to the doctor as infants and children, right? Somebody would say, well, now it's time for this vaccination, and it was sort of part of the regular set of activities that happened during well child checkups. And I wasn't in a position at the time to think about questioning that. And my kids also, my kids went to daycare. They started in daycare when they were about a year old, each of them. And there were requirements to in sending your children to daycare in Virginia, just like sending them to school. So I was a conformist, like most parents, and didn't really think about it. But I also wasn't part, it was interesting because I was a member of La Leche League, and which is a breastfeeding support organization. And in sort of breastfeeding circles that I was in, there were parents who were questioning vaccines. But I, for some reason, that whole conversation really was not a part of my social networks when my children were little. And I really only became aware of it, as I said, through colleagues and friends who were having children 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years after my kids were born.
The people who refuse vaccination, does anybody have any grasp on how strong or how, for better way of phrasing it, I guess, is how large a group of people this is?
It's the number of one of the ways that we measure this is the number of children who are fully non-vaccinated. It's still very, very small in this country, under 2% of all children. Now, that number has been increasing over. I think there was a recent study done that showed that children who were born I'm going to forget the actual sort of dates, but like basically there were sort of two dates that were chosen in the 2000s, and it was shown that from one period to the next, there was an increase in the number of children who were fully unvaccinated. Now, that said, there's also been a decrease over the years in the number of children who are not vaccinated because they lack access to medical care. And this started with the Vaccines for Children Act in 1993 under Bill Clinton, which made federal provision of vaccines for children on state Medicaid and other forms of provision easier. And I think that it increased under the Affordable Care Act under Obama, as insurance companies are required to buy vaccines that are routinely recommended by the CDC. So what you see is what I argue early in the book is that the proportion of children who are sort of purposefully non-vaccinated, maybe increasing proportionally within the group of children who lack vaccines, but that number overall is very low.
Mm. But, you know, the beliefs that the parents are expressing, the parents of those kids who are not vaccinated, some people might think, you know, that's kind of, they're out there, so to speak. But their beliefs are not really fringe, are they?
It depends on who you talk to. There are some fringe beliefs that occur, but of course there are fringe beliefs that occur in all portions of the population. Most of us have some belief somewhere that is kind of an outlier. But no, one of the things I try to do in the book is demonstrate that things that bother people about vaccines, the people who are vaccine dissenters, are actually quite common or common trends in contemporary culture. So, for example, distrust of big pharma and its relationship with medical government medical regulatory groups that make recommendations for vaccines, distrust of government bureaucrats making decisions for the rest of us, concerns about the environment, concerns about what we do to our bodies in the service of health that may in fact cause other harms that we're not tracking. Those kinds of concerns are not limited to vaccine dissenters, it's just that they turn this particular set of concerns to vaccines in ways that the majority of the population does not.
Mm. But vaccination, has it ever been, I guess, universally accepted in our society?
No. There's a kind of a myth that vaccines used to be accepted, by the sort of, well, I guess here, I'll start again. Vaccines have been accepted by the majority of the population in this country as a preventative health practice. But there have always been a significant portion of people who resisted vaccines or who were skeptical of vaccines or who vocally dissented. And you can see it, so historically it goes all the way back to the late 18th century when the smallpox vaccine was invented. And especially in the 19th century in both Britain and the United States, there were riots against compulsory vaccination. A good example is the 1950s when the polio vaccine was developed and then federally licensed and disseminated in the mid-1950s. There's this sort of mythology about all of these children who were volunteered by their parents to take part in the vaccine trials, right? So these were the last part of the experimentation process to make sure that the vaccine was safe and effective. And it is true that hundreds of thousands of children were volunteered by their parents to get this experimental vaccine, the Salk polio vaccine. But it's also true that hundreds of thousands of children in the catchment areas for the trials were held back by their parents and not allowed to participate in getting the experimental vaccine. And so you see there this kind of tension between after it was licensed and disseminated, there were immediate concerns that not enough parents were getting their kids vaccinated. There had to be these sort of persuasive campaigns and mechanisms to get people to be vaccinated. So there's always this tension since the invention of vaccines between those who are sort of proponents and kind of zealous adherents and those who are more skeptical, who want more time, who want to see how other people respond to the vaccine, or who really are just against vaccination and do not want to be vaccinated.
What about media coverage of vaccines, vaccination? How has that changed over the years?
So that was a really interesting finding. One of the things that I was interested in looking at was sort of trying to answer the question of why we have such inflammatory coverage now that it tends to be vilifying and shaming, even from very venerated news outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post. So I had a group of students look back at sort of mainstream news reporting on vaccination from about 1980 to 2015, and what we really found is that through the 80s and through the 90s, the news reporting was really what you would expect, relatively neutral, and there was actually a lot of sympathy for parents who were concerned about vaccination dangers. So there was very sympathetic reporting about parental concerns with thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative that used to be used in vaccines in the United States. So the reporting really changed after 2000, and especially, I argue, after 2004, 2006, and there were sort of a variety of influences on that change, but 9/11 happened, and there was an increased concern about bioterrorism and the anthrax scare that happened right after 9/11. And then in 2004, there was an Institute of Medicine report that could not find connections between either thimerosal or MMR and autism. And so the notion was that there was a set of scientific studies that did a large meta-analysis that demonstrated no connection between those, the vaccines and autism. And then in 2006, when Gardasil, the human papillomavirus or HPV vaccine was licensed and approved and recommended for use among preteen girls, there was a huge backlash when states started to try to mandate the vaccine, and parents, especially parents on the Christian right, decided that were against that. And so then there became this sort of mantra in the news that, look at these conservative parents, this is a vaccine that prevents cervical cancer, how can they not be in favor of it? And so there was and then of course there was the introduction of social media and Facebook, 2004. And so you have this change the way we report and we talk about things in the media, and you have these influences that lead us to a situation today where much of the reporting is vilifying and shaming, immediately moving towards an analysis that it's got to be anti-vaxxers who are at the cause of every outbreak of infectious disease that we have. And the truth is always more complicated than that.
Bernice Hausman is talking with us on our program. She is the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. As I mentioned in introducing her at the beginning of our discussion, she is the chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine. You mentioned the A word a few minutes ago, autism. Mm-hmm. And since 2000, or the turn of this century, a lot of the attention that has been given vaccines has focused on the potential connection to autism. What do we really know about that potential connection?
Well, that depends on who you ask, but there continue to be significant portions of the vaccine dissenting community that are committed to the idea that there's a connection between vaccines and autism. The mainstream biomedical researchers have not found a linkage, and so there continues to be persistent sort of pressure on that point because of this disagreement. Now, what I would say is that what's interesting to a researcher like me, who's researches the cultural context, is the question of why, in the face of such kind of a staunch repudiation of this idea from mainstream biomedicine, is there a persistent belief among people? Why do people go to the meetings of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC three times a year, where a group of experts makes recommendations for vaccine use in the American public? Why do people go and at public comment continue to talk about the connection between vaccines and autism? To a group of people who do not believe that there is a scientifically demonstrated link. So there's very, very interesting sort of cultural conflict going on there, and the persistence of this belief in the face of a lack of scientific evidence, or at least a lack of scientific evidence that mainstream scientists agree on, is really a kind of a fascinating cultural phenomenon. I don't have an answer for it.
Mm. The role of parents takes many forms. And in an age where, you know, we have all this information literally at our fingertips, or at least the access to the information, how does a parent act responsibly when it comes to vaccination?
Well, you know, Bob, this goes back to the question you asked me initially about my non-decisions about vaccinating my own children. Mm-hmm. And because I think that it's a fascinating thing that we're, in general, when it comes to health practices, we're recommended by many different kinds of experts to do our homework and to inform ourselves about what we're doing and not do things blindly. And yet, with vaccination, we are in fact rewarded by following the recommendations of the CDC in following a particular schedule when it comes to vaccinating our children and in fact vaccinating ourselves. What we see is that school entry mandates in this country, which are state-level laws that demand that children have a certain number and kind of vaccines and boosters before they go to enter into organized daycare or schooling, that those are really what maintains a rather high level of vaccination in this country, because when we see vaccines that are recommended but then not included in those school entry mandates, uptake is much lower. Uptake is much, much lower. And so whether or not that is an effect of parents paying more attention and doing their homework, or just the logistics of vaccination that mean that they just don't, you know, get around to it, is very unclear, but you see that people's sort of disposition is not necessarily to follow through with recommendations unless there's a kind of a situation in which you know the rubber meets the road and you have to, otherwise your child won't be able to go to school. Question about parental responsibility, of course, is the focus of one of my chapters, and it really is this. For parents who do take that question seriously and are dedicated to ensuring that they know everything that goes into their child's bodies, they oftentimes run into a wall where it's unclear to them that vaccination is safe based on what they see as the ingredients when they research themselves the ingredients of vaccines. Now, on the other hand, you could argue that we have history of safe monitoring of vaccines once they have been licensed and approved and are routinely given out to millions of children every year, that we have a sort of set of monitoring activities where the safety and efficacy of vaccines is, in fact, monitored quite closely by the federal government and others, and that that monitoring system does not demonstrate significant adverse reactions to the routine vaccines of childhood. But that's where you really have a kind of a disagreement among vaccine dissenters and mainstream biomedical government regulators.
Final question for you, because this is an area that has been in the news in different areas of the country. In New Jersey, this was a huge issue recently at the State House,
mm-hmm.
where there was a move to abolish exemptions.
The non-medical exemptions,
exactly.
Yes. Yeah. So that's actually been, I think we're in the middle of a really interesting kind of natural experiment with respect to that. New York got rid of its non-medical exemptions this year. California did that in 2016. Maine has done so, but I think it will take effect next year or the year after. And I believe Washington State got rid of non-medical exemptions with respect to measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR. So it's an interesting, historically, non-medical exemptions have worked to dissipate political dissent about vaccination by allowing some people who are really ideologically or otherwise opposed to vaccination a kind of an out, so that the vast majority of people will be vaccinated and the mandate will hold. So it's kind of like you allow some people to opt out in order to ensure that most people opt in. So historically, it's worked that way since the first conscientious objector laws were passed in Great Britain in 1898. So we will see whether or not in this country now, given this sort of begin the changes in the laws, whether or not there's a change in the way that these vaccine mandates work politically. My apprehension is that by people who are against vaccination are very, very worried about the increasing mandates by restricting the non-medical exemptions, and I think it's going to lead to increased political dissent from vaccination because people are going to feel backed up against a wall, and you see that in the incredibly vociferous dissent that occurs when this legislation is considered at the state level. I also think that you will see, as we have seen in California, an increase in medical exemptions and an increase in homeschooling, as the law can only cover those children who are in organized schools. And so the question of whether or not that outcome is worth the marginal increase in vaccination levels, I think we will be able to track that and study that in the future. States like New Jersey and New York have actually extremely high levels of vaccination, and the question of whether these laws are going to give us higher levels, I think, remains to be seen.
Bernice Hausman, who is chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine and the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy, our guest this portion of our program. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ann Liguori's Talking Golf is along at 7 this Sunday morning. The fabulous Karina Delgado, who joins us from one of our sister stations, The Drive in Washington, D.C., with a contribution, timely one, too.
I'm Karina Delgado with 94.7 The Drive. Now, I know with the COVID-19 pandemic taking up so much of our mental space, it's easy to forget that things like Earth Day are right around the corner. But I am on the phone today with the Vice President of Conservation International to speak about our Earth, the environment, and the COVID-19 crisis, and how the two are inextricably intertwined. Hi, Shyla, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling, Karina. I'm doing really well, thanks. How are you?
I am doing the best that I can every single day, just staying grateful and washing my hands.
Exactly, same here.
If you could, just please take a moment to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Great, thanks. My name is Shyla Raghav. I am the Vice President of Climate Change at Conservation International, and my role is to oversee our climate change strategy and programs. Conservation International is present in about 30 countries around the world, and we have our headquarters is in Arlington, Virginia, and our mission is really about protecting nature for the well-being of humanity. And so the types of solutions that I work on are stopping deforestation, providing support and guidance to governments and to local communities to find investment solutions, policy solutions to protect nature for a more sustainable and healthy future.
Sure. Speaking of protection, we are all in protective mode right now. Protect our health, protect our families, protect our community. With that said, I think comes a sense of question, and people are speculating on whether or not the COVID-19 pandemic is a result of climate change. Can you speak to that a little bit for me?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important question. And I think that our tendency is always to try to find connections between trends, but also to be able to find or get some good news, right, or find a silver lining amidst everything that we're experiencing. There isn't really any strong evidence that climate change is a direct cause of the coronavirus and its spread. But what we do know is that climate change has a direct influence on the migration of species. And so in particular, what we're seeing is that ranges of species, whether it's even trees and plants where they can grow, or migratory patterns of species like fish or even birds and insects. These are all changing because of shifts in temperature and precipitation that is being caused by climate change. But I'd also like to highlight the fact that climate change is something that could multiply the losses and damages in times of crisis. So imagine if on top of dealing with COVID-19, we were also experiencing a drought or cataclysmic fires like we saw in Australia or in the Amazon. Well, it would really just have the impact of exacerbating those inequalities.
For example, we have seen some unusual earthquakes as well as tornadoes happening right now. And as we experience in our own communities the COVID-19 crisis, I can only imagine the devastation somewhere that was, you know, hit by a tornado during a time like this.
Exactly. And climate change can also affect human health even more by putting strain on vulnerable populations, or even increasing things like heat stress or the spread of disease vectors like mosquitoes that increase incidence of diseases like malaria. And so the human health implications are really going to be even more difficult to deal with when compounded with viruses and diseases like COVID-19. So I really think the main message here is that climate change and human health are inextricably linked.
Mm. Now, what we're seeing as a result of people social distancing and isolating in their homes is that pollution levels have dropped around the world as people stay home. Is this a hidden benefit of the pandemic? Do you think this will inspire people to limit their fossil fuel use once things get back to normal?
Yeah, I think that's also another trend that we're seeing so much in the news. And I think, you know, as I mentioned, I think everyone's looking for something positive to come out of all of the negative consequences of COVID-19. But I wouldn't necessarily call the drop in air pollution levels a hidden benefit, because they're likely just going to be temporary. And we haven't really, as a society, made the systemic shift that are needed for these gains to persist or be sustained in the long term. So the way that I'd rather look at some of these short-term benefits is to focus on preparation and how we could have prepared better. So imagine if we had listened to the warnings from epidemiologists and others and prepared, right, 5, 6, 10 years ago. How different would that outcome have been in terms of how we're dealing with and experiencing losses due to this crisis right now? How would we have changed the future, and how would we have acted to do that, even just so that the virus could be contained or mitigated and our economy could be more resilient and prepared for that? So I think with climate change, the timeline is very clear, and so are the consequences. Mm. So the question that we have now is, how will we use these next few years, knowing what we know now and knowing that we have the opportunity to prepare better and to create a more resilient economy, so that we don't have to lose jobs, we don't have to decimate our economy. We can actually address climate change by building new and clean and thriving economies. So that's really what I hope we can take away from our lessons from dealing with COVID-19.
Oh, absolutely. Because learning from the tragedy is the most important part of triumph over adversity. That said, what can we do to make those preparations?
Yeah. So in the next 10 years, the science is really clear. Emissions need to be halved by 2030. So we basically have a decade to cut our emissions in half. And we know the types of solutions that can get us there. So it's clean and renewable energy. It's greening our agriculture system and our food system through regenerative agriculture and shifting towards more of a plant-based diet. Shifting to public transportation, reduction of overall consumption like plastics and other products that take a lot of energy to produce. So making those immediate changes now in our infrastructure, in our decisions and our patterns today can set us up to be in a position to really achieve that outcome over the next 10 years. The second thing I would say is that since climate change is fundamentally, like COVID-19, a global crisis, it's going to require worldwide cooperation and attention to really focus on a coherent and coordinated global response, where we can see a basis for global signals, global alignment and redirecting of financial flows. And so that's the second thing I would say, is just really band together through political signals and political processes that can help develop a global response. And then the last thing I would say is to support natural climate solutions, which includes planting of trees, restoration of natural ecosystems, and protection of standing forests. This is really my personal passion, because a third or more of the solution to climate change comes from protecting and restoring nature. And guess what? These solutions can also help maintain the resilience of our planet, provide us with clean air and clean water, and might also very well prevent the spread of viruses that so severely affect human health as well.
I absolutely agree 100% in that it is going to require everyone working together on the same page in order to surmount seemingly impossible feats, for sure. One last thing, Shaila, before I let you go. What is one way individuals can give back to nature and be a part of the bigger climate solution at the same time?
Yeah. 2020 is such an important year, so I think making addressing climate change a priority, making it a voting issue, an investment lens when you're looking at where you put your investments, your retirement portfolios, make it demands that we make as shareholders and consumers of many large companies, talking about it more. There's really something that every single person can do, no matter what your skill set, to activate creativity and kind of that ideation process of bringing solutions to the market. The other thing that people can do is use a tool that we developed that is available on our webpage. It's a carbon calculator, and it allows users to measure their carbon footprint and give back to conservation projects designed to keep forests standing and to help scale up restoration efforts. So listeners can visit conservation.org/calculator. And after using the calculator and assessing their carbon footprint, they can learn more about reforestation and conservation projects to which a donation can help support forests in the Amazon, in places like Peru or Kenya. And so this is really something specific and tangible that everyone can do immediately, and can also help us to maintain our optimism, our hope, and our sense of community in coming together around addressing climate change and protecting our planet for our future.
Oh, I absolutely love that. Okay, so while our listeners have, you know, a little bit of time on their hands and they're on their computers, they can check out that carbon calculator. Can you give us the website one more time, please?
Absolutely. It's conservation.org/calculator.
I love it. All right, Shaila, thank you so much for speaking with us today. You stay safe out there.
Thank you, Karina.
Karina Delgado from one of our sister stations, The Drive in Washington, D.C., joining us on our program on The Fan. It's Ann Liguori, who is talking golf at 7 this Sunday morning.
We are joined in this portion of our program by a guest who we've spoken with at sort of the tail end of 2019. Here we are, we're in a new year, and he is joining us to talk with us about a new project. We're talking and joined on our program by Rich Cahan. He had joined us before on our program. He, along with Michael Williams, have been involved in putting together a publication entitled River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It. Richard and Michael are both photo historians, and they have some interesting things to share with us. He's joined us by phone on this portion of our program. Rich, it's nice to talk with you again.
Hey, Bob. Thank you so much for calling.
What was putting this project together? What was this like? And how'd you come up with this idea?
Well, as you mentioned, my colleague Mike and I are now considered a term photo historians. It's a term that we weren't even sure what it was when we first heard it. But
you had to Google it, right?
And there was no Google.
Right.
So actually, we're both journalists, but but we write books that are oftentimes based on photographic collections, and we use those collections to help better understand life. We did a book on the incarceration of Japanese Americans, where we used photographs from the government that showed what it was like during the World War II for Japanese Americans to be taken away and interned during the war. And we came across a collection of interviews of formerly enslaved men and women that are actually online. It's on a site, the Library of Congress site. And we've been reading a lot about those interviews. There's been many books based on them, but very few books have ever taken the portraits of these formerly enslaved men and women and paired them with their words. And by connecting the photographs and the words, we found there was great power. In the late 1930s, the federal government interviewed over 3,000 formerly enslaved men and women, and they photographed a little over 300 of them. And this book is a look at 96 of those interviews, and we've taken the essence of their words and combined it, paired it on the next page with photographs.
How did you choose the 96?
Well, we've studied slavery pretty extensively in the last several years, and we wanted to touch all of the major issues that we wanted to talk about work, we wanted to talk about identity, we wanted to talk about we wanted to talk about violence, and we wanted to talk about the end of slavery. The end of slavery at the end of the Civil War in the South. So we talked about freedom, and we talked about Reconstruction, things like Jim Crow, things like that. And we were always looking for moments where these people talked about these issues, and then we would combine their portraits.
And in doing a project like this, what do you... I always like to ask in interviews what people get out of the experience. I mean, what did you learn from this?
Oh, my gosh. Like most people, I learned about slavery first, I think, in high school. And I didn't read many firsthand accounts. And that's what this does. This is not filtered through any historians. These words are not filtered through any historians. And I think the accounts were eloquent and mind-opening. And it brought me back. It helped me very much understand what happened before and during the Civil War in the South.
And the power.
Yeah.
The sheer, and I'm going to use the word raw, power that not only the words but the pictures have.
Absolutely. These words are poetic. They're from the heart. It's just a gift that the federal government did this in the late 1930s, that they thought that the experiences of the formerly enslaved men and women were important enough to document. They did it carefully. And interestingly, this collection is called the Slave Narrative Collection. And many people know about the collection, but it's the photographs that have been forgotten. And to see an 80-year-old man looking back and saying that he was given away as a wedding gift by his slaveholder. And you see him as a dignified older man, and they talk so matter-of-factly that this happened, that they weren't trying to. There was great kindness in their words. They were trying to reconcile what they had gone through, but there was certainly a directness to what they said.
Well, it's as you're saying that, I'm thinking it makes the experience of reading, of viewing the pictures, it makes it personal.
It does. It's as if they're right across from you.
Exactly.
And you can see them. Interestingly, when the project was conceived, John Lomax, who was the anthropologist who was one of the visionaries of the project, saw this idea that it was as if they were in a convention. They had a convention, and everyone was getting together, and they were all comparing notes, in a sense, about what life was like. And that's how we put this book together. It's not just 96 random thoughts. One person leads to another. It's as if somebody stops their story. It's just like a conversation, and somebody else would pick it up almost from there. So we've divided it into, you know, different chapters, and there's a chapter of, you know, as I said, identity, and what, and a chapter on what life was like day to day. And so you go through this experience with them.
So it gets us so much away from, and it was something that in a way seemed like you might have kind of been alluding to, because many of us are experienced in the formal education process with learning about slavery was rather detached. You know, it was the intellectual approach. You know, it in many cases it was you were just literally just reading words. Okay,
absolutely. They talk about the capitalism of slavery. In high school, we learn about the politics of slavery. It always then kind of slides over to the Civil War, but there's very little about the what happened, human, personal. You know, that's what these accounts. That's how these accounts affected me.
And the other aspect of it is, when this ended, you know, at the end of the Civil War, what happened?
Those are some of the most worthwhile moments in reading it, because what happened was there was no plan. All of a sudden, for many, they weren't even told that the Civil War had ended. They weren't even told they were free. Oftentimes, slaveholders took months to say anything because they wanted their fields cultivated. Some people, it took years to learn. But when they learned, there was this moment of, what do we do now? You know, but a majority of formerly enslaved men and women could not read or write, so they didn't have those skills. They certainly had other skills, and those skills basically kept them in the fields. And oftentimes they continued working for their slaveholder because, you know, with a very, very modest income, because they had no choices.
Mm. Wow. This type of approach, you know, it's a treasure in a way that these interviews were done. And this is a long time ago when they were done. And as you said, you know, there are people who know about the fact that the interviews took place, but the images basically could have been lost forever.
Yeah, that's what struck us the most. Interestingly, the photographs were taken by the men and women who interviewed, who did the interviews.
Isn't that interesting?
And it's very interesting. And they weren't professional photographers. So
that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. We're used to doing books by really, you know, Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans and great names in photography. But these were amateurs who basically were given little brownie cameras usually. And they were, and usually the interview would end with, and there's notes of this, do you mind, ma'am, if I take your picture? And they would say, sure, that's fine. And at first, you know, the pictures are, I would say the pictures are somewhat amateurish because they're not taken by professionals. So sometimes they're a little foggy. But once you get beyond that, you see the incredible value of these photographs, because here you have people who are posing, sometimes usually very dignified. The men oftentimes put on suits. But oftentimes they're posing in the field, and you see their suspenders, and you see their old shoes. One or two people have their pants being held up by rope. I mean, these are very, on the whole, very poor people. But the dignity they bring to this portraiture is remarkable. And then you see little hints, the rocking chair, the porch, the house, the fields in the background. One woman posed in the middle of her wash on the line. And in work clothes. And these people are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. But somehow they knew, they could sense how important this was. This was their one chance to both talk about their experiences and, I don't want to use the word pose, they did pose, but pose in a really beautiful, dramatic way. And these photos were pretty much forgotten, and that's what I think if there's any new ground that this book does, it's taking those photographs and connecting to these words.
Did you at all wonder why no one else had approached this
I did. And I think the answer is that for so many academicians, and those are the people that have written these books in the past, and there's been many, they never value photographs the way they should.
Why?
Because I think they're trained to use words, and they're trained in the value of words. And, you know, if you look at history books, I mean, academic books, there are pictures sometimes in books, but they're oftentimes called plates, and they oftentimes don't even connect with the section in the manuscript. You know, they'll talk about somebody, and then 2 pages later, you'll see this person, and they'll literally say, you know, see figure 1.3. And they don't understand the power of words and pictures together on the whole. And I think that's what happened here. Mike and I looked at each other. This was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. We kind of came across this collection, which most of the pictures and most of the words are actually online, but they're not online in this way. And we realized that when you look at somebody and then you hear their words, that it creates a power that nothing else can do.
Yeah, it's interesting because as I'm listening to you talk about those academics and, you know, I'm thinking, in a way, they have a word bias that is taking place there, although I understand it's well-meaning on their part. We're talking on our program with Rich Cahan. He is talking with us about the publication River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It. He is a photo historian. He, along with Michael Williams, putting this publication together. Why that title for the publication, by the way?
Well, we saw references to blood so often in these interviews. I think there's 6 or 7 of them in my book, and there's dozens, obviously, in the entire slave narratives. And we kept thinking about this image that keeps coming back to people who talk about slavery. Blood was a part of their lives. And so we took it from a quote, one woman talked about seeing a river of blood. Her name was Lou Williams, and she talked about hearing people holler, and when it rained, she could just see streams of blood where the whippings had taken place. And we wanted to cue people into the fact that this is a pretty unvarnished view of a real tragedy of American history.
I mean, talk about painting a real picture of what took place. I mean, what you just said in quoting her, I mean, the power of that message.
It does. There's a lot of humor and there's a lot of hope and a lot of accounts of resistance in this book, but there's also a lot of violence. There is. We didn't want to avoid it. We weren't interested in avoiding it. This is the one chance for people in America to see it together, you know, and so It's a rough but important book, but I think more than anything else, it's a book of testimony. It's a book of testimony that really provides insight and eloquence, and you know, the terrible odds that these people lived under, and how here they are in 1937, almost 75 years after slavery, after it was ended, and they're sitting on their back porch and they're talking about it. It's a book of the triumph of humanity in many ways.
It's a book of America.
It is.
You know, when you get right down to it, it really is. I mean, it's an American history lesson.
And the experiences that these people faced did follow them throughout their lives and does follow their ancestors.
Mm. Well, that's the interesting thing as well about this because, you know, you think of the words, you think of the images, and then you think of the legacy of all of this. What is your hope that those who view this work are going to take away from it?
My hope is that they'll read it and look at it. After that, I don't have any great hopes because I think that the words are so powerful and the pictures are so important that I'll leave it to those two things to affect them. I can't imagine somebody looking at this book and not being affected and learning more about, as you say, America, about American life.
And you talk about the story of America. This smacks you in the face at times because, yes, there's some brutal honesty in it, but it is a phenomenal history lesson.
Yeah, I think I go back to the words and how eloquent they are. Most of these people were interviewed by white men and women,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes these men who were not trained dialecticians, but they tried to capture their words in what they considered was exactly how they heard it. So there is this African American vernacular English in many of the interviews, and at first it's kind of like when you were in high school and you started reading Huckleberry Finn and you saw the dialect there and you thought, I can't read this is too hard. But after you read a couple of them, it gets very easy, and you see the beauty of these words. One of the Works Progress Administration administrators, which oversaw this process, really talked about it being poetry, and that's exactly what I think it is.
Phenomenal project. Our guest this portion of our program, Rich Cahan. Rich, along with Michael Williams, photo historians for River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It. Thank you very much for joining us. Certainly the best with this publication. I always ask, what's the next project?
Bob, for once in our lives, we're slowing down and this is the most important project we've ever done, and we intend to talk about it and promote it, because not because we're promoting the project, but we're promoting what's inside it, and we think that's really important. So for right now, we're concentrating on this book.
I think I may fall off my chair. You're actually slowing down and
well,
taking this in. Good for you.
We hope to. It's hard. We really care about this. You know, you mentioned one quick thing. You mentioned about words and the importance of words, and now I think in society we really see the importance of pictures. You know, try putting a Facebook post online without a picture, and you'll see how many people look at it. So I think that we've come around to understand the value of photographs.
We certainly have. Thank you very much for joining us. Certainly the best with this effort.
Thank
and
you.
With your work.
Thank you, Bob, very much.
This is Bob Salter. Thanks for joining us on our program this Sunday morning.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.